President Biden was in Tokyo yesterday for the launch of a new economic framework in the Indo-Pacific region. Former President Trump pulled the U.S. out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, when he came into office 5 years ago. Since then, the U.S. has been in an uncertain position when it comes to leadership in the region. This new thing is called the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework for Prosperity. It's not a full-on negotiated trade deal like the TPP. So what is it? And what does it mean for the American economy? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you in favor of some kind of rebuilt economic bloc in the Pacific with the U.S. part of it? What questions you have about the United States could benefit or not from a new economic framework launched in Tokyo this week? Where does China fit into all of this? And do you personally want to sell more stuff in your line of work to that part of the world? Or does your business rely on buying stuff from the region? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Kristen Vacasey is an associate professor of political science in the School of Policy and International Affairs at the University of Maine. Her areas of expertise include international political economy, the geopolitics of supply chains, and Northeast Asia. And she earned her PhD in political science from UW-Madison. Kristen, welcome back to Wisconsin.
Thanks for having me. So happy to be here today.
All right, let's look first at this thing, this framework. Now, the Trans-Pacific Partnership was this long process, carefully negotiated tariffs and blah, blah, blah. What is this thing and how does it compare?
Absolutely. So during the Obama-Biden administration, there was a move to try and be a rulemaker in the Indo-Pacific region, what we call now the Indo-Pacific region. And particularly the Trans-Pacific Partnership was this effort to show economic leadership through building new standards, through increasing market access, through lowering non-tariff barriers, having shared investment standards, and even a few labor and environmental standards were thrown in there as well. It was painstakingly negotiated. And then during the 2016 election, it got very much thrown out under the bus by both the Democratic and Republican candidates. And on his first day in office, President Trump said he was throwing it out, much to the dismay of the other members of the agreement. Now, in response to that, Japan in particular took leadership in the TPP, and the remaining countries did sign something now known as the CPTPP. And there really still is a lot of appetite in Northeast Asia and across the whole Indo-Pacific region for these really detailed, comprehensive kinds of trade agreements in order to integrate supply chains, et cetera. So when Biden comes into office, he's faced with this challenge of how does the United States try and show economic leadership in this really prosperous part of the world that is eager for more interconnectivity and eager for real rulemaking without making the same domestic political mistakes that were made with the TPP. And right now, his answer is this Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, which maybe we could say IPEF, but maybe we can just go with IPEF.
Yeah, it doesn't roll off the tongue exactly, IPEF. Now,
no,
a lot of this is defined by an absence here. The TPP did not include China. This IPEF, or whatever we're going to call it, doesn't include China. How big a part of the story is saying we'd rather have the United States be part of this kind of trade than let China dominate it?
That's a great question. So to some extent, there is eagerness to build a set of shared rules and standards in the region, whether it comes from the United States or China or Japan or whichever large economy is going to take that lead. There's eagerness, and you can see this. There's a whole constellation of trade agreements, of economic partnership agreements, of bilateral investment treaties, including the CPTPP, but also agreements like the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, RCEP, which was signed last year and does include China, as well as most, not all, but most of the countries that are also involved, part of this new IPEF. And so to some extent, countries will join all of them. The countries, they're joiners. They'll join all of these agreements. But to some extent, the deliberate exclusion of the world's second largest economy from this agreement is showing that the United States would like to be a leader and take leadership in the region independent of China.
We're talking to Kristen Vacacy from the University of Maine, looking at this loose trade agreement signed between President Biden and a bunch of countries in Asia, Australia, the Indian Ocean region as well. It's not the Trans-Pacific Partnership. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions about all this at 800-642-1234. Are you glad the U.S. got out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership? Should we be trying to get back into it? What do you want to see? What do you want our economic relationship be with countries in that big region? And how about China along the way? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Kristen, there are some kind of main principles that are part of this framework for prosperity, as the administration is calling it. One of them, and you mentioned supply chains, and that's been obviously a huge issue this last couple of years. That's a big part of this, supply chain resilience. What are people talking about here?
Yeah, so we have seen supply chain disruptions, many of which were caused by the pandemic, but there's also other economic issues that have caused some of these supply chain issues that are contributing to inflation. Right now, the supply chain resiliency initiatives in this agreement are trying to have better information sharing, transparency in supply chains in order to guard against the kinds of price spikes and the kinds of supply disruptions that we've been seeing for the last few years. Now, you might think of things like semiconductors, and that might be part of this agreement. Taiwan is not part of the agreement, which is a large supplier of semiconductors. So maybe that's something we could talk about. But one of the things that's specifically mentioned are minerals and in the initial fact sheet from the White House. And we rely on China for a lot of critical minerals like rare earths. But there's also these minerals are also found within the region and the countries that are part of or have signed on initially to the IPEF. And they include things like rare earth minerals, but also things like nickel and other minerals that we need to make batteries, to make permanent magnets, to make all the sorts of fancy technologies that enable our modern life and will help us transition from fossil fuels.
We sometimes hear from the Biden administration and others the solution to the supply chain, the international supply chain problem, is to make more stuff here, to try to make the United States a manufacturer of microchips and some of the other things you just mentioned. Is that at odds with trying to get together with all these other countries and make sure that the stuff flows from there to here more easily?
I don't think it is at odds. It's with things like chips as well as with minerals in current demand, but even more predicted demand in the future is so high that we need all of them plus. And one of the benefits of an agreement like this, if it follows the path that we see in the initial language, is that you would have shared production standards, shared confidence that if a chip or a refined metal was made in one of the countries that's in the agreement, you would be getting the same quality and the same sort of process, hopefully the same environmental standards, the same labor standards in any of these countries, and it would facilitate imports and exports. And I think that also would help build more resilience for American manufacturing if it's done right.
Here in Wisconsin, we got a lot of manufacturing, a lot of agriculture. That was a lot of the focus here on Trump administration agreements with China, for example, the hope that we'd be able to sell more of that stuff to them. That never seemed to really come to fruition. Are these things we're talking about with these countries as part of this framework for prosperity?
To some extent, one of the critiques of the IPEF right now is that it's unclear what sorts of things the United States is going to offer to member countries or ask of member countries. You know, it's kind of clear what the Biden administration wants a end map to look like with, you know, supply chain resiliency, clean economy, some things with digital economy and whatnot, but it's unclear what that might mean for market access going either way. And that absence is something that we'll really need to pay attention to over the next few months as countries start to negotiate.
We're talking right now about a new economic framework President Biden and leaders of a dozen other countries rolled out yesterday for the Indian Ocean, Pacific Ocean region. It's a big region. Our guest is Kristen Vacacy, Associate Professor of Political Science at the School of Policy and International Affairs at the University of Maine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What would you like to see get hammered out between the U.S. and all these trading partners in the Pacific region? What do you think about China's influence there? Are you glad the U.S. is trying to take an active leadership role in trade in the area? Would you want to go back to something like the Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiated under the Obama administration, rejected early on in the Trump administration? Do you have worries about trade with a lot of these countries? Call 800-642-1234. With your questions, your comments, that's 800-642-1234. You could also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about a new launch of the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework this week. That's a deal between the U.S. and a bunch of countries, including India, Japan, South Korea, Australia, Indonesia, many more, establishing trade guidelines, cooperation guidelines on economic issues between these countries, but not a full-on trade agreement like the canceled Trans-Pacific Partnership. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions on the U.S. role in that region, what you'd hope for from trade agreements, loose or tight with those countries, your hopes for something that might affect your own business, maybe. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Kristen Vacacy stays with us, Associate Professor of Political Science in the School of Policy and International Affairs at the University of Maine. Kristen, if this isn't like a full-fledged negotiated agreement like the TPP, does it really matter? Does it make a difference? Or is there something significant here?
That's a great question. So one of the reasons that this is not a trade agreement is it makes it more plausible that President Biden will be able to make some agreements in a shorter time frame with these partner countries. And so the goal right now is sort of the 12 to 18 months, there'll be some announcements of what's come out of the IPEF. And that can be done with executive action rather than votes by Congress. Now, the benefit of that is the shorter timeframe, but of course, that also means that partner countries might be skeptical that the commitments the United States makes and the agreements will last past a single administration. And so that's a risk in negotiation and might lead to they're more watered down agreements and maybe not as strong of rulemaking as you might see under a trade agreement. But it does allow the Biden administration and perhaps also the governments in Japan, South Korea, other member countries to be a little bit more to have a little bit more flexibility in their negotiations because it's a lower level than a trade agreement. So I'm hoping my optimistic view is that we're going to see some lively negotiations towards sort of the low-hanging fruit in negotiations, things, maybe the easier things on digital governance, maybe some things on shared standards, et cetera.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jim is with us in River Falls. Jim, hi.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. So I guess, you know, when they negotiated the TPP, my concern about that was it was mostly negotiated behind closed doors with these major corporations having a lot of input into it. They didn't have human rights groups or environmental groups provide a lot of input into those agreements. And my understanding was that that would have benefited companies. It would have given them basically autonomy in areas where they had the corporations that they weren't subject to, like, our national laws or federal laws here or state or local ordinances either. So it was a win-win for the corporations, I think, but not necessarily for working people or, you know, people that are abused in foreign sweatshops.
Jim, thanks a lot for that call. And Jim really sums up very nicely, I think, Kristen, a lot of the objections to the Trans-Pacific Partnership in the first place.
Absolutely. That's a great comment and a great question. So indeed, so some of the big concerns that we saw were things like lack of transparency in the negotiating process. I think that the coverage of this question of supranational autonomy of MNCs with the TPP was a bit overblown. But there were also concerns that the TPP didn't take labor concerns seriously enough, and also that it didn't take environmental concerns seriously enough. And particularly, those are things that where the United States has typically higher environmental and labor standards than the partner countries. And so if we don't have shared standards and shared rules, that gives American industry and American manufacturing a really big structural disadvantage. And so the language of the IPEF includes those concerns. It indicates that the Biden administration witnessed what happened with TPP and said, okay, on this next round, we are going to focus on those issue areas that had such large political problems in the TPP negotiations. Now, that does not guarantee a different outcome, but it does show attention to these problems. And in trade negotiations typically are private. And they do involve countries giving up sovereignty and then agreeing to rules that are shared across borders instead of being made at a national congressional level. And those certainly introduce the tension between national sovereignty and international agreements.
Thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking with Kristen Vacacy from the University of Maine, looking at President Biden's trip and dealing with international trade partners in Asia and the Indian Ocean region. A loose framework kind of agreement, nothing as precise as the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Kristen, another absence here. You mentioned Taiwan, a big economic power in its own right, not part of this deal. Taiwan in a weird position diplomatically. It's its own country, clearly, except China says it isn't. Diplomatically, people have to deal with it, pretend it doesn't exist. The U.S. policy has been strategic ambiguity, not saying whether or not we'd defend Taiwan if China attacks it. President Biden saying, yeah, we would. Can you talk about the Taiwan issue here?
Absolutely. So it's always difficult to talk about Taiwan because of there's a linguistic dance around the One China policy about recognition of Taiwan or non-recognition of Taiwan, but acknowledging China's policy that Taiwan is not a country. There's a lot of difficulties here. Most heads of state from around the world have messed this up, and the government in China typically responds in an aggravated way, as what happened this time as well. Strategic ambiguity, the goals to try and deter China from a military takeover of Taiwan, perhaps something like what we see happening in Ukraine right now. So deterrence without aggravation, and so to maintain the status quo. Biden's statement was more straightforward. And this is not the first time he's made such a statement. It's the third time. I don't think that it really changes Beijing's understanding of what the United States would do, although there's of course a robust debate about that. But I think the United States has been pretty clear that we would defend Taiwan since the Taiwan Straits crisis in the mid 1990s, when we brought the fleet in and indicated that indeed we would defend Taiwan. So I think it's strategic ambiguity, but there actually has been less ambiguity. But this question, this political question of Taiwan, we do see it playing out in the IPEF. Here's a place where we do see U.S.-China rivalry in the region affecting what happens in economic agreements. So countries like Malaysia, the Philippines, Thailand, it would aggravate their relationship with China if they joined an agreement where Taiwan was also a member. And so although there was interest in bringing Taiwan into the IPEF, they were not invited for these political reasons.
Now, briefly, if we're trying to work as part of this is the supply chain stuff like we were talking about earlier, if we don't have Taiwan in here, which provides so many of the chips that, you know, a bunch of cars and parking lots in the Detroit area are waiting for, We don't include China, which if it shuts down Shanghai, say, because of COVID, we feel it here in the United States. How much supply chain can we fix without those two?
Sure. So there are, we're doing things to fix the supply chain without this agreement. And hopefully Taiwan will be brought into some of these regional agreements at some point. They have, for example, applied for membership in the TPP, and that probably would help alleviate some of the chip issues. But I think that broader regional cooperation in standard setting would help alleviate supply chain issues, but that the political reality on the ground is that the United States needs to start here, and then maybe over time can start to incorporate some of those other countries.
And just our last half a minute, Kristen, what are you watching for next on this framework?
I'm watching to see the countries can choose which pillar of the four pillars they want to join. I'm waiting to see which countries will choose which pillars and whether we'll do bilateral or multilateral negotiations.
Kristen, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed the conversation.
That's Kristen Vacacy, Associate Professor of Political Science in the School of Policy and International Affairs at the University of Maine. We talked with her today about a new economic framework, they're calling it. President Biden and leaders from a dozen Pacific countries laid out this week for the region, what it could all mean for the U.S. and for some of the supply chain issues still plaguing the U.S. economy and the rest of the world for that matter.